The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished fund manager Josh Northrop of Whitman Asset Management. So welcome, Josh.
Morning, Paul. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Yeah, well, we've got lots of big macro information and data points coming out over the next few weeks, not least tomorrow's US CPI and the kicking off of the US Q1 earnings seasons on Friday with the banks. So putting all that together, what's your sort of like your broad outlook for equities going forward, particularly in your sort of like your sweet spot of small and mid caps?
Well, I think when we last spoke in July last year, we were sort of in the midst of a pretty horrendous bear market. And I mean, certainly in the UK at that point in time, inflation was double what it was in America. And consequently, UK equities were underperforming and were really out of favor. Fast forward, well, I mean, 9 months. And I think, you know, the macro situation in the UK is definitely better. You know, inflation has come down materially. It's at 3.5% now, just under. And that's down from a peak of, you know, 11%. And I think the economy has done better than people were expecting. You've seen rising consumer confidence, increasing real wages, record low unemployment still. So I think the macro picture is actually one that's improving. And I think people, fundamentally, things haven't played out as bad as people feared. If you think about the markets, I'd say the markets have improved a bit. If we think about our market, small mid caps, the market is up about 15% from the lows, which was in October. But if you look at the American small cap market as a benchmark, relative benchmark, the Russell 2000 is up about 26% off the lows. So we've probably underperformed on a relative basis about 10% versus the US. I think it's hard to compare us to US large caps. They're in a world of their own. So I think, you know, the situation is better. You've seen markets pick up, but I think the two observations that we would make at the moment is that despite the 15% rally in small mid caps, the UK remains in absolute terms very cheap in terms of multiples. I think on most metrics, you could say that 20 to 30% cheaper than comparables. And that's on a growth adjusted and an industry adjusted basis. And comparing, you know, UK multiples to private equity multiples or internationally listed peers. So you are seeing a discount, but it is starting to close a little bit. And you've seen ongoing public market takeovers, which is evidence of this discount. We've had 12 bids in the first quarter at 100 million market cap or greater. That was some research put out by Peel Hunt recently.
Yeah, one a week.
Sorry?
One a week.
Pretty much, yeah. And what does that tell you? That tells you that financial and industry buyers are feeling still optimistic about the UK as a place to buy assets. And it tells you that the markets are still cheap. Interestingly, the initial premiums are 29%. On average across the first quarter, but shareholders are putting up more of a fight now than they were, you know, last year and the year before, and you're seeing counter bids and revised offers to get bids over the line. Some really good examples, and that's meant that actually the average kind of bid after considering those things is closer to just shy of 40%, which is still material. So that's the first observation, is that I think the UK is still cheap. And the second observation is obviously that the US large cap market has been on an absolute rampage and has outperformed everywhere else materially over the last 12 months. And I think, you know, money flows have been going to America to get access or to get exposure to, you know, a select number of stocks that are giving, you know, artificial intelligence winners like Nvidia and Meta, etc. And I think, you know, effectively the markets are perhaps slightly overlooking other parts of the equity market, perhaps where there's glaringly obvious value right now. And one of those areas is the UK, which is for various reasons we all know about why the UK has been undervalued the last few years. But to us, it seems unlikely that this trend will continue in perpetuity. I mean, the US is trading on a very high multiple now, and that relative valuation gap is unlikely to keep expanding. So I guess any reversion to a more normal US premium could result in money flows coming back into undervalued parts of the market.
Yeah.
And that could be a catalyst for the UK. But I think generally we're feeling like, you know, markets have picked up a bit. They're still looking cheap, but the macro picture is improving, and we're in a much better place than we were 9 months ago.
And what will reverse those outflows into sort of like UK small and mid caps? Will it be interest rates coming down? Because we could get a CPI, this is fingers crossed, print in the UK in May, you know, looking back into, get this is for the April numbers, of 2% or less. And if we do that, is that going to be the sort of the flag that allows Andrew Bailey at the Bank of England to reduce interest rates in the summer?
Possibly. I mean, I think markets are anticipating interest rate cut, you know, within the next 3 to 5 months, probably. It's hard to know exactly if that will stop outflows. You've had, you know, a lot of outflows from growth equities, from small cap equities. That's not been a phenomenon only in the UK.
Mm.
The US has suffered similar outflows from small caps. I mean, small caps are inherently interest rate sensitive, and it takes a long time for the hikes in interest rates to filter down into kind of capital allocation amongst investors. So there's still people still adjusting their portfolios for high interest rates. But the rate of outflows is slowing materially, I think, over the last couple of months from the peak. And I think any interest rate cut would be supportive of starting to get money to come back in.
Mm.
But it may not happen immediately. Of course, on the flip side, you've got the M&A and the corporate buybacks, and that's, you know, been very supportive of the market. You know, despite the outflows, the market's up 15% from the lows. So you have seen some of this bid money and some of these corporate buybacks start to filter back into the market. And so I think, you know, that's the flip side of this. I mean, it's been painful for fund managers in the small cap space to hold on to assets and to pitch for new assets. But, you know, as the performance picks up a little bit and people start to identify the opportunities again and the value in the market, then you start getting money coming back into the market. And that's, you know, the sign of a pretty strong bull market to come, hopefully.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of investors, myself included, have been struggling in the first quarter. It's been a bit sort of soggy, to say the least, after a good close, a bit of a Santa rally last year. Okay, well, let's hit some stocks then. One is really done well over a long term is Netcall, which is a leader in all things software for call centers, I think, into sort of like, you know, the financial sector, but has moved into robotic automation management software as well to help those contact center guys improve the productivity and efficiency. Can you take us through this one? Because it's not particularly cheap, but it's obviously a very good long-term winner.
Yeah. Well, as you say, I mean, the business started out as a kind of communication software company on premise, and they moved into this sort of industry called intelligent automation in 2017. When they acquired a company called Gloco. And intelligent automation is really around designing solutions for companies to help improve automation, you know, around workflows and processes. So, you know, it's all about driving efficiency ultimately within an organization. And they have a platform called Liberty Create, which is a low code product. And low code is basically, I mean, think of it as a piece of software that enables people who fundamentally can't code to be able to create basic automation processes. And that in itself helps companies become more efficient. And this is an accelerating space, you know, within automation, i.e. enabling people who aren't technology people to actually create and manage the process automation.
Yeah, a bit like a co-pilot to help the contact center guys.
It's making complicated things straightforward
for idiots like me
and me. So it's a big market. Yeah. They specialize in public sector and financial services. The market's growing 20% plus a year. It's mission critical software. So once a client has used the software to create a piece of automation, perhaps if you're a potential customer of a bank and you're on their website and you're looking at their mortgage calculator and, you know, various different pieces of information that you put in will drive a response from the website. I mean, that in itself is a form of automation, and that is, you know, in many cases or in some cases, you know, it'll be NetCall's low code product that is facilitating that automated response. So once they've, you know, used the software to create a degree of automation or a workflow, it becomes very embedded in the operations of the client. So hard to displace. It's subscription based revenues, very strong customer retention, and I think that the number that we would say is most impressive with NetCall is their net retention with their cloud-based revenues, which is 119%. So what that's basically saying is that if they don't win any new customers in a given year, you know, their existing customers grow 19% net each year, which is a very strong rate of growth without winning any new customers. And so land and expand, you know, as you roll out the software throughout the organization and add different kind of modular upgrades. So yeah, it's not a cheap stock. You know, quality comes at a price. They've had some sort of jigging of some large contracts that the market didn't take particularly well. And they've also increased investment more recently. So there's been a sort of downgrade in profit around that. But fundamentally, it's very high quality revenue stream and very cash generative business. They've got customers like the NHS, Lloyds, Nationwide, Santander, big financials predominantly. So, you know, big market, strong growth, strong margins, it's a company we really like.
Yeah, no, I can understand that. I mean, looking at the sort of EV to sales value, it's still only 3x. The question, I guess, is there an opportunity to increase the margins there? Because they're about 16% EBIT. And for a software company with high recurring revenue streams, and as you see, and you say, sort of like, you know, they're landing and expanding with a high net recurring revenue, you know, that sort of like net retention rate, then you'd think they should be able to do 20% plus.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is. I mean, the cloud-based, not all of their products are cloud-based. They've still got some legacy on-premise solutions. So it's been a transition to the cloud. But
yeah,
as that continues, that you'll see those margins tick up. And as I said, they've recently increased investment, which we think is a brave and good thing to do with a business like this. This is a company that's proven its ability to be very profitable. It's got great customers, it's growing. But if there's an option to slightly put your foot on the accelerator and grow at a more attractive rate for longer, then that's something that we're supportive of. But of course, it costs a bit more money to get there. So that's something that, you know, we're happy with.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think it's a really good business, and it wouldn't be surprising if somebody put the slider all over there, because one of the, I think a private equity house bought Gresham House, the Gresham Technology this morning.
Yeah.
So this is, looks like a similar sort of business. Okay, let's move to one actually, which is, it's an adjacent market actually on the software, Cerillion, which basically does SaaS software for billing, customer service, and customer relationship management for the telcos. Now, the sort of the real optic that stands out is that I know they're slightly different and they work in slightly different verticals. One telecom wears this, you know, the previous one, Netcore, was more sort of the financials and NHS. But the EBIT margins for Cerillion, looking at it, are 38% plus for this year compared to 16%. For Netcall. Do you take us through what the differences are with Cerillion? Why does it make such good margins? I mean, it's and obviously it emphasizes the upside potential for Netcall.
Yeah. Well, Cerillion's been one of the best sort of performing software stocks on the market over the last 5 years. And by all accounts, has kind of defied the bear market. It's been one of the few stocks that...
Well done.
Has done really well in a falling market as a highly rated software company. I mean, as you say, they do you know, enterprise billing and charging and CRM software for telco companies. And basically, what's happened over the years is as telco networks have become more sophisticated, the underlying client of the telco, their contracts with the telco and their needs have become more dynamic. So around things like data usage or different pricing tariffs, traveling internationally with your phone and stuff like that. And of course, as these things have developed, the sort of software requirements for the telco to run operationally efficiently have become a lot more complex. So historically, telcos largely used to build their own software for things like billing, and now it's just not really viable because there are lots of different things that you need to be tracking. So that's what Cerillion do, and they focused largely on small telcos initially. You know, they've got a solution that's off the shelf. It's not bespoke for anyone, so that's partly why the margins are so high. And it's cloud based, which means they can implement upgrades seamlessly.
Yeah.
It's very rich in terms of its functionality. It's very focused on the end customer. And so, you know, a number of these factors have contributed to a very attractive proposition for telcos, and they've been very successful over the years, basically moving from small clients. Sort of £1 to 2 million contracts, perhaps a small operator in a small market to starting to win much bigger telcos. You know, they've signed sort of £10 million contracts and they are now pitching for some sort of £25 million contracts, okay. Really big contracts. And so if they sign a big contract, then once the implementation's done, it's very, very high margin because the software's already built, it's not bespoke, it's just integrate and let the client run off the software. So it's one of the highest margin businesses that I think you'll find on the market. I think I would caveat our enthusiasm for the company just by pointing out that the valuation is reflective of a company that's done very well. And so, you know, from our position, it's a company that, you know, we've been taking profits in over the last few years. We still have a position in it, and we still think it's a great business. But you know, you can't say that it's not on a particularly attractive multiple.
Yeah, well, it's so over 9x sales, isn't it? So
yeah, you know, and in a 30+ PE multiple, but you know, if you win a £20 million contract and you're doing that at, you know, very high gross margin, then the upgrades can be very material.
Yeah.
And that's what's happened historically. So yeah, they've got some amazing customers, like people like Manx Telecom and Three now. And I think they've got customers in over 40 countries. So, you know, it's a global business.
Yeah. No, it's real high quality, no doubt about it. Another one, which is benefiting from the digitization of all things, sort of, you know, rail, et cetera, and electrification, is Tracsis, which basically does software and services into that vertical, whether it's through ticketing, whether it's through safety of tracks, whether it's through data management, traffic management, et cetera, routing and this sort of stuff. And it's obviously a champion in the UK with Network Rail and has branched out to the States. And it seems to be, you know, well, it's reasonably valued, but there's lots of upside there, I would have thought.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's got a really nice track record in terms of growing organically and also doing bolt-on acquisitions. We've done 17 bolt-on acquisitions since 2009. And, you know, they've been very successful at buying bits of technology that are accretive to their offering. And that's almost entirely been self-financed. So they're not one of these companies that keeps coming back to the market to issue shares, which is something that we really don't like much, unless there's a very good reason for it, because it's dilutive. I'm happy to support deals. They make a lot of sense, but often they don't. So Tracsis are very disciplined. They generate cash. They've got very conservative accounting policies. They expense most of their R&D. So, you know, it's a very clean business from an accounting perspective, which we really like. So the multiple does look, I guess, up with events, but you know, there's very limited kind of capitalization of R&D. So that PE multiple is clean, I would say. Yes, I mean, they've started to win some contracts in North America, selling a couple of their different solutions for the rail, you know, for the transportation industry, helping make rail operators and rail networks more efficient and helping them cope with digitalization. I think there's hopefully more to come in America. I think there's a big opportunity there, and the management seem quite confident, but yet to sort of get a series of big contract wins, I would say. Strong balance sheet, 20 million of cash, and I think, you know, it's a high quality business that is very well run, and I would recommend people have a look at it.
How achievable is the sort of the H2 target? Because I was just running their, you know, their numbers and their estimates, and they reckon they're going to do 36.5 million, I think was their trading update for the first half, which means they've got about 49 to do compared to, say, 37 in the first half. So 49 in the second. Bit of a leap of faith, that one. But the management seem pretty confident because they've got a lot of new contracts coming on board, which should start generating revenue.
I think that's it. I mean, look, with any business like this, it can be hard to forecast exactly when contracts are going to land. With our discussions with management, they seem pretty relaxed about the forecasts. And as you say, they've got contracts that are coming on in the second half. But you're right to point it out. But I, you know, we would encourage people to think a bit longer term. And this is a company that has a very good track record in growing organically and acquisitively, with very good cash generation, and you know, whether they grow a little bit less this year or not is, you know, is anyone's guess.
Well, I mean, you know, the secular growth in digitizing rail, I mean, it's a must have, isn't it? Because unfortunately, so many delays or strikes or all kinds of different disruption just in the UK. If they can get the UK right, they can get anywhere else around the world correct. That's for sure.
Exactly. Yeah, our trains are a bit of a mess.
I know. Okay. Well, let's move to another dominant sort of vertical software company, Auction Technology, which is basically it brings buyers and the auction houses together online. And I guess the sort of, like, you know, you have this networking effect gives it barriers to entry, but also you presumably need a super low latency network to be able to allow people around the world to bid at the same time as people actually who are there physically in presence around that sort of auction circle.
This is a company that got a lot of hype when it listed. It listed back in 2021, right in the midst of the bull market. And I remember the IPO was massively oversubscribed, multiple times over. And it pretty much listed on a PE of about 50 times, and a cash flow yield of 2%. So if you fast forward 3 years, I'd say the company's performed fine, a bit better than expected for the first 18 months, and then perhaps a bit worse than expected for the next 18 months, but broadly okay. They've made a couple of acquisitions, but the multiple's now 19 times.
Yeah.
So you've seen a derating of over 50%. And fundamentally, the company hasn't really changed. The end markets are attractive. It's they've got a market leading position in the UK art and antiques market and the US industrial and commercial markets. And as you say, they provide the digital marketplace for the auction houses to run auctions online, which is a growing market. They've got about 2,000 auctioneers across their different marketplaces that are using their platforms. I think market leading position is the key because you have network effects. Mm. Think like Rightmove, you know, it tends to be a winner. Doesn't take all, but you big advantages if you have the predominant network where people go because the buyers need the sellers and the sellers need the buyers. There's still only about 20% of, you know, auction items in some verticals that are sold online. So there's a big long runway. There's a long runway of growth for more of this to go online. It makes a lot of sense. You've got access to more buyers, which should give you better pricing. It's more efficient, lower cost to run. So there's lots of advantages to it. The trouble they've had more recently is that the growth of the business was accelerated by COVID when everything shut down. Of course, everything went online. And then you've had this period after COVID where the growth has been a bit disappointing because people have been going back to bricks and mortar a little bit. You've had a bit of an unwind of the COVID, the COVID growth. So you've got to take a view on whether or not you think the industry is going to get back to kind of more traditional growth in online penetration. And we think it will. They make their revenue by taking a commission on the items sold on one of their marketplaces. They take about 3% broadly. But there's an opportunity now for them to sell value-added services like things like marketing and payments and also fulfillment and delivery of the goods to drive that take rate up closer to sort of 5%, which would be more akin to other e-commerce marketplaces like eBay or something like that. So even if the end market or the online penetration doesn't grow much, they have got the opportunity to grow that take rate from 3 to 5 and then further, which provides a pretty good runway of growth, which is something that we really like about the business, is they've got this kind of opportunity to sell ancillary services from a very low base. And that's the part of the business that's now really growing, you know, 20% plus. So lots of opportunity to grow. I think the market was a bit concerned about some of the acquisitions they did possibly. And the multiple was very, very high for a very long time. But, you know, we've been building a position in it more recently. And we think, you know, 19 times, it's a September year end for a business that does 40% margins and a very high cash generation. It'll de-gear very quickly. Yeah. The multiple will be more like 17 times next year. But that sort of business, you know, look at where the likes of Rightmove and Auto Trader have traded historically, and that's on much lower growth now compared to what ATG, we think, can deliver. So potentially this stock could re-rate if interest rates fall, and also if they start to... that organic growth just starts to tick up as we get back to more normal levels of growth within the industry after COVID.
Yeah, just in terms of the actual leverage, it's nearly on about sort of like, you know, net debt to EBITDA, roughly just less than 2 times. When does when just more broadly, when does that become a sort of concern? I mean, I guess these, you know, ATG is pretty sort of recurring revenues or repeat revenues with high cash generation. But when does it become a sort of concern, a sort of like a point that flashes into Josh's mind that this looks a bit elevated?
Well, on average, our companies have net cash.
Yeah.
So that tells you our view of leverage. We'd rather not have it.
Yeah.
If a company does have it, it depends on the business and the business model and the cash generation. I think with ATG, I think it's inherently very cash generative, and but I do think that they went a bit fast on some of those deals, and I think that has dampened the ability to get the marginal buyer in the market, because people are thinking rates are rising, this company has debt.
Yeah.
But as it starts to deleverage and rates start to fall, that goes the other way quite quickly, and there is the opportunity to make money out of the stock. Is potentially getting in now with the view that it's going to deleverage quite quickly, and then people will look at it very differently.
Okay, good. Well, okay, let's pivot. Let's go to a different sector, into healthcare. One sort of like is a bit of a fallen angel, hasn't fallen that much, but is Advanced Medical Solutions, which is a sort of industry leader in wound care and tissue healing. And it used to have a really rock solid balance sheet, but has now decided to do a sort of like a transformational acquisition of Peters Surgical out in Europe, which seems like a perfect fit. The market didn't quite like the price they paid for it, but it seems to have high IPR and good barriers to entry. What's your latest on this sort of like strategic move by the business?
Well, I think before looking at the acquisition, the market needed some comfort that the business was kind of getting back to the growth that it had done historically. I mean, growth had slowed over the recent years, and that was partly because of COVID reducing the number of procedures, and particularly in America. But also they had some issues with their distributors in the US, and some of the competitors that started to bundle products and kind of push them out of the market a bit. So they've had some issues in America, and they've now gone live with a new distributor. And, you know, the reference that they made in the statement was that they feel like things are coming back to life in America in quite a positive way. So that's quite encouraging, and I think would have pushed the stock up. But then they announced this acquisition, the Peters Surgical, which is a much bigger acquisition than anything they've done in a long time. I think it's over 130 million euros.
Yeah, 141 euros, yeah.
Yeah. Euros. Financed through a net cash position and then taking debt on. And that obviously, changes the parameters of the balance sheet a bit. But I don't think it's overly geared. Possibly people are wary of the amount of money they're spending on an acquisition that's previously been owned by private equity. Difficult to know right now if the acquisition will turn out to be a success or not, but our inclination is to continue to back the management team. I mean, there's good rationale for the deal, which the company, Peters Surgical, has a very strong presence in Europe. And that kind of complements AMS's exposure in perhaps the US more. And it gives them genuinely kind of market leading position in terms of their product breadth across their portfolio. That's what they're really referencing, and good opportunity to cross sell into respective geographies where the different businesses have a greater presence. So Hard to say with absolute certainty that it's going to be a slam dunk success, but the management team have been very successful over a very many number of years. And we think it's a very high quality company with lots of IP. The end markets have had a more challenged time, principally by COVID, but things are starting to come back to life now, in particularly in America, in terms of returning to a degree of normality in the way that the healthcare, you know, market is operating, and inventory levels and, you know, it's kind of procedure levels, etc. So, you know, this is a stock that historically is traded on a 20 plus 25 times multiple, and assets in this sector that have a degree of scale and IP are highly valued. It's, you know, hence it's cost them a bit of money to buy this business, Peter Surgical, but if they can deliver on some synergies and get the business growing, you know, back at where it has historically, you have to say that the multiple looks very attractive compared to, you know, listed peers or private equity multiples.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And as you rightly point out, elective procedures are definitely coming back in the States. You just got to look at the big healthcare insurers out there. They're saying all the same thing. And I would imagine the management team of Advanced Medical will have certainly known Peter Surgical for years, and will actually, you know, so the risk of actually integrating it should be less, because it isn't something of going into unknown territory. This is a very much a business that they'll have kicked the tires well beforehand. So yeah, I'm with you. Okay, good. Well, let's move to animal healthcare. We've got CVS, really topical, because it's obviously one of the biggest UK vet practices, and we've had that competition markets authority investigation, or looks as though it's going to kick off. And then we had yesterday, it had unfortunately cyber attack, but the shares went up, which was quite positive, I thought, actually. So what's your latest on this one? Because it's battered the share price. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It trades at 10 times PE, which for a high-quality business has got a lot of bad news baked in.
Well, I think you've said it there. I mean, unfortunately, we've been in it, and we've suffered the fall.
Mm.
So I can't say I'm overly happy. But if I wasn't in it and I was looking at it, then maybe this is a very interesting opportunity. I mean, fundamentally, I mean, people probably know the business. It's the second largest veterinary practice in the UK, not about 9% market share. It's a very resilient business in terms of the end market, and it's consistently delivered, you know, like-for-like sales growth, mid to high single digit. I don't think any of that's really going to change fundamentally. The trouble is that there's been a lot of consolidation in the sector. CVS have been part of that, but there's been some private equity backed businesses that have been very acquisitive as well. And the consolidation in the sector has been so significant that the CMA have started to look at it and in light of customers complaining around the price of pet care and you know, potentially not having enough choice within certain regions between different providers, and which ultimately leads to perhaps poor pricing for the customer or more pricing power for the supplier, which is in a way the signs of a good business model. But when you're dealing with animals and, you know,
emotions,
people and emotion, that's when the CMA start to come in and look at things and possibly assess whether or not there's been some behavior that warrants more regulation. So it's very hard to know what the outcome of this is going to be. The reference points that they've made have been that they think that customers haven't got enough choice, potentially been overcharged for procedures and medicines. And they're looking into the sector. So potentially some companies have to sell some of their assets to increase competition in certain regions. Potentially they regulate drug pricing a little bit. you can't regulate it too much. You know, CVS isn't sat there making 65% margins. It's making a margin that's comparable to veterinary practices in other countries. So I think it's probably understandable that the regulator's looking at it, but I don't think this is going to be the death of the business, personally. Far from it in many ways, but you have to accept that this could go on for quite a long time.
Yeah, okay.
Possibly a year and a half. And that will hang over the shares. But on 10 times, you can make very good money if whatever they decide isn't catastrophic for CVS. And someone's going to continue to serve this market. A lot of people have pets. A lot of people need pet care. So it's not going to disappear. And I don't think, in our view, there's any signs of fraud or like gross misconduct from a management perspective. So if I was looking at it now, it could possibly be very interesting. Maybe not immediately, because I think it could go on for a while, this, but possibly, you know, in a year's time might be worth thinking about having a small position, because, you know, it could be quite a big uplift on the valuation, subject to what they say. Potentially quite a binary bet, but worth flagging. And it doesn't always end in tears. I mean, we saw with Emis, you know, when they got bid for last year, was it a year and a half? It was 2022, I think, when Emis got bid for initially. You know, that went to the CMA and it went on and on and on. In the end, they put it through, they accepted it, and that was selling, you know, a key asset. Selling, you know, a key asset for the NHS, effectively one of the big NHS software suppliers, to a US company. So, you know, these things can seem very negative, and then all of a sudden the result is not catastrophic, and the shares can react very quickly. So possibly an interesting one.
Yeah. Well, as Warren Buffett regularly says, invest when there's blood on the streets. And there's definitely plenty a lot of blood there. Okay, let's move to another sort of dominant position in the industrials. We've got Porvair, which does all things sort of like filtration and laboratory and environmental sort of technology. It basically helps the technology and its filtration expertise helps its customers produce better quality products that can then sort of like, you know, improve the environment, improve the product performance, etc. And it seems to be operating a lot of sort of niches, growing very well. But the shares have now come back, actually. They're usually always priced very highly, but they're about 17 times PE with balance sheet, with lots of cash on the balance sheet as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of our portfolio is made up of just really, hopefully, high quality businesses that have delivered over the long run. And there are some companies that are more kind of turnaround situations, but the vast majority of the businesses that we like to invest in are kind of proven, you know, great businesses. And if you look at this company, you know, 15 year earnings CAGR of 12-13%, consistently making good margins, market leader. You know, they're specialists in filtration and environmental technology. They've got very niche markets that they sell to, with very long life cycles, whether it be, you know, the aerospace or clients buying their products and designing them in for 20 years or more, ultimately. So it's not, you know, recurring revenue, but once you've won and been designed in, it's heavily repeatable. Very high barriers to entry with Porvair. I mean, why the multiples come down a bit, hard to know. I mean, as we've discussed, the UK has been suffering a little bit from outflows and stuff, and stocks that haven't been coming out with big upgrades or doing things exciting have perhaps suffered a bit more because there's been less of a kind of marginal buyer around them. But at these levels, I think, you know, it looks like a really sensible business to be adding to a portfolio, in our view, except for the long run, you know, growing at an attractive rate, well into the teens on a constant currency basis at the top line. And they've always had this ability to do, again, self-financed bolt-on acquisitions, don't come back to the market, which is great. So yeah, we like it.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, it's got 12% EBIT margins, which I think for a high specialist business like this, it's probably got scope to it to increase. Trades about 1.5 times sales. So very reasonable value for a long-term compounder. Let's move to another one of the industrials. We've got Johnson Services, which it does sort of like cleaning workwear and renting out workwear, blue collar, and increasingly in sort of the catering and in leisure sectors. It's got lots of economies of scale. I guess the question is this one is sort of like, yes, it's come back obviously off the pandemic as people have gone back to work, particularly in catering and stuff. Is this a secular grower or a cyclical business?
That's a good question. I mean, elements of it are cyclical and elements are pretty resilient through the cycle, but it's been taking market share fundamentally. This business right. has been taking market share for years and years and years.
Who from?
From smaller competitors.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
They've been making acquisitions. They consolidated smaller players. And also, as you have a downswing in the market, smaller players find it very hard to survive.
Yeah.
So they win business. But also on service and proposition and pricing and all the other things that mean that you're attractive to win business. But yeah, I mean, they provide, it's basically a laundry business,
yeah,
you know, for workwear and the hospitality markets in the UK. So again, it's pretty sticky client base. Imagine running a hotel without your linen, you know, it's impossible. So, you know, you need Johnson Service Group.
Yeah.
They've got market leading position, which is something that we really like. 15%, I think, in hospitality market share and closer to 40% in workwear. So very good position. I think the opportunity for Johnson Service Group at the moment is, and why it's a big position for us in our portfolios, is that there's a margin recovery story alongside, right. You know, top line growth. And I mean, what happened in kind of the when Russia invaded Ukraine is the price of energy went up a lot, as you know, and energy is a large percentage of their cost of sales or a large percentage of their revenue. And the way that they hedge their energy is they're always trying to de-risk short-term volatility in the cost of energy. So it took a bit of time for the massive spikes in energy to actually hit their P&L because they had a lot of it hedged. But of course, when they started taking out the next contract, those contracts were being done at a much elevated level. So eventually, of course, the price increase in energy did hit their P&L, but it was slightly delayed to other companies. And you've seen the margin, effectively the kind of margins of the company have gone from kind of 15 closer to sort of, you know, 11, yeah. 10, 11,
yeah.
with energy being the vast majority of that difference. Energy yeah. gone from 6% of turnover closer to kind of 10. So fundamentally, do you think that energy prices will stabilize? They've already come down a long, long way. It's just that it'll take a bit of time for that to hit the cost base at Johnson Service Group because they've hedged a lot of it out. So that's a big opportunity to get those margins. And management have guided to getting the margins back to 15%.
Right.
Which on a much bigger revenue base than
yeah.
pre-COVID, because they've put through big pricing increases, they've been winning business. That's not forecasted in the market. You know, analysts have not put out numbers that get you back to those margins. They are showing incremental improvement year on year.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's upside in that. And then you've also got a management team that have been investing in capacity. They built a new state-of-the-art facility in the southeast for £15 million to do 600,000 items per week. I mean, this is a company that's investing and taking market share.
Yeah.
And whenever you have a big downturn, like you've seen it, you know, because of energy and because of COVID shut down the hospitality market, a lot of their smaller competitors have just, you know, have struggled and have gone bust. So big opportunity for them. The multiple's about 14 times this year. But if you think energy gets back, you know, the margins get back to where they were, that would put it on closer to about 10 times. Yeah. And then you've got the growth in the top line over the next few years, and you've got probably ongoing M&A as well. This business has always made sensible bolt-on acquisitions. They built a business in Ireland recently doing linen into the Irish healthcare market, which is a new vertical for them. So that's exciting. It's not the most exciting business, Paul, but laundry, and laundry is ultimately a pretty good business if you can get it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's one of those companies, isn't it, with basically pretty much a very strong sort of, like, you know, position in a market, growing, and it's got a lot of self-help it can do, improving its margins. So I'm with you, and it's on a reasonable valuation. So, yeah, looks like a pretty good, sensible thing to add to your portfolio. Okay, let's move to tech hardware. We've got Calnex Solutions, which the shares used to be a bit of a, you know, were really highly priced. I think, again, it listed a couple of years back, come off quite a bit. But it does all the testing and instrumentation for 5G wireless networks and digital. It does them also actually for the fixed line as well. But I guess the big question at the moment is one of its, probably a customer, I don't know, Spirent, is being bought by two of its, or should we say, is being bid for by two of its competitors. And what that means for Calnex, for who would probably work further down the food chain.
Yeah. I think with Spirent and with Calnex, it's kind of, I guess, a good example of how the market is very keen to value things very well when things are going well.
Yeah.
And then when everyone knows they operate in a cyclical market, or there's elements of cyclicality, when things get a bit tougher, you know, share prices can collapse, and the bid for Spirent at such a premium is evidence that the market is overly pessimistic with the way that it's valuing some of these companies now. There are differences between Spirent and Calnex, but ultimately they're playing similar trends, or you're giving you exposure to the same kind of underlying.
Are they competitors, or does Calnex supply into Spirent?
Well, yeah, Calnex supplies into, I mean, Spirent's predominantly a reseller.
Yeah.
So Calnex has its own IP and its own technology, but is more specific in its capabilities and what it's doing. I mean, they have a very specific set of test and measurement equipment for very specific telecom and high-speed data networks. Whereas Spirent is selling many products and many different test products for the telco market. So you could say that Spirent's more diversified in the exposure it's giving you. Calnex is more specific. But yeah, I mean, look, the business is run by its founder, a chap called Tommy Cook, who still owns, I think, about 20% of the company. And, you know, it's got a market cap of 50 million now, with 13 million in net cash.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you think that there's any chance of it getting back to doing the same levels of profit that it did 2 years ago, then you're going to make multiple times your money from here. But, you know, the speed at which the telco market recovers is an unknown entity. So it's more speculative, but it's not going to go bust, you know. And that's the key for us, is when you're in something that comes, you know, gets more challenged. And with Calnex, because it's small company and highly operationally geared, I mean, the revenues fell, whatever it was, let's say 20%, but the profit disappeared. And if you're sat there with a net debt on your balance sheet, then that's when, you know, the bankers start calling you up, and you've got the insolvency practitioners coming around to your office. So I think the fact that they never had any debt. They always had cash, you know, between, you know, 13 and 20 million. And they've been able to run the business basically at break even, broadly speaking, which is all, you know, that's what you need.
Yeah.
When things get tough for a small cap. And now the question is, do they push on? And they came out with a statement the other day that basically said they're going to get back to growth this year. They're going to grow on last year. So, you know, you're going to see some growth. It's not going to get back to 2022 yet, but you're going to see some growth. And I think that's the key.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, work in progress, but and as you say, a lot of positive operating leverage there because it's high gross margins. Let's move to a different segment. We've got the consumer. We've got Bloomsbury Publishing, which has been a real sort of workhorse for you guys and keeps going from strength to strength. It started off obviously with the, you know, sort of the Harry Potter series, which has continued to do well, but they've found another absolute darling in book publishing, Sarah Mass, it's really sort of turbocharged the business. What's your sort of latest on this one?
Yeah, really like the business. It's a core position in our small cap fund, has been for a while. I mean, historically, the company got very, it hit success very early on, shortly after it was founded, when it got the publishing rights for the Harry Potter series, which has gone on to be probably one of the most successful publishing deals ever. And it's that still generates significant revenue and profit for the company, the Harry Potter, you know, brand. But they won't disclose exactly how much it is, but it's meaningful as an ongoing contributor. All you know, 25, 30 years after this book first came out. So that's pretty incredible. More recently, they've had big success with Sarah J. Maas. You know, the American fantasy author, and you know she's had a phenomenal run of books. Her most recent book came out at the start of this year, called House of Flames and Shadow, which raced to New York Times bestseller, and her back catalogue, you know, continues to sell very, very well. So, you know, they've had another great success story with Sarah J. Maas. But the part of the business that we think is really attractive and of particular interest is their digital resources division. And this has been something that they've been developing over the last few years. Effectively, it's online content, publishing content for universities and the academia world, so students and to libraries, and principally in the humanities space, which is where Bloomsbury are very strong, and they made a few acquisitions in this space over the last few years. It's a relatively nascent division still, doing in terms of subscription revenue about 15 million annually, and this is selling, you know, packages to universities to get access to this online humanities content. You know, they've got the platform now in place. They've got a wide range of universities subscribing to their content. And so now there's an opportunity to cross-sell by adding more content to the platform. They're doing that both organically, but also acquisitively by buying small niche, you know, publishers that don't have the online capability, don't have a platform themselves, buying them, taking the content, making it more digital and driving cross sell to their client base that they don't really have. So this is a much higher margin business. It's a higher quality business. Margins are 30%. It's more recurring revenue.
Yeah.
There's inherent operational leverage within that division. And we think as that division grows, it'll pull up the margins of the group and it'll pull the rating up of the stock. What's happened over the last 2 years is that Sarah J. Maas has done so well that actually the digital side of the business as a percentage of group turnover has gone down despite growing. So the reasons we bought the stock, you know, are not, you know, it's not that they haven't been successful. It's just that the Sarah J. Maas story has been so successful. The challenge with something like Sarah J. Maas is you don't quite know how long they're going to be around for. I mean, she could, you know, she's signed on for another 4 books, but she's not going to release one this year, we're told, or another one this year. So it's lumpy. And you don't know if her next book is going to be that good. It's impossible to tell. So, you know, that's why that publishing side of the business is kind of like a low teens multiple, whereas the digital resources with that recurring revenue, and it's sticky and it's not reliant on one big hit, one big author, is a high teens multiple. And if you think that's going to grow more quickly, then that's going to pull the multiple of the group up. They've got a very, very strong balance sheet. I think at the end of this year, they'll have in excess of 60 million in net cash. So that gives them firepower to do these deals, which will inherently be accretive and drive upgrades. The valuation is, I think it's about 16 times.
Yeah, 16 and a half times,
But if you take the cash off, because it's, you know, it's 15% of the market cap sat there in cash at the end of this year, then it's more like 14 times. And if you, you know, all of a sudden you're sat with a multiple that's reflective really of a traditional publisher, opposed to a business that's got this digital side that could, with another couple of years of growth and an acquisition or two, be a meaningful contributor to group profits.
Yeah. No, I would agree. I love it. I think it's really good. Okay, let's move to another one, which is probably a bit like Johnson. So is McFarlane, which does sort of like specialist packaging, sort of, is it cyclical or is it sort of like secular sort of stuff? And it's a sort of like, it's a business that's 225 million market cap, just a bit of debt, trades on about 12 times PE, but as I say, does specialist packaging for brands and companies, I guess.
Yeah. So on the face of it, the business operates in quite a boring market. I mean, they're a packaging distributor, so they sell packaging from a supplier to customers across in the industrial and retail sectors, like Honeywell and Johnson & Johnson and ASOS, etc. And their customers typically have such sophisticated packaging needs that it's much easier for them to go to a distributor like McFarlane, who will manage all of their packaging requirements and all of the SKUs, and they'll manage the inventory, the transit, so that their customers don't have to sit there with loads of boxes in a warehouse for, like, you know, 10,000 different SKUs and manage the working capital that comes with that. So it's not everyone would use a distributor, and I think it takes a bit of work to get your head around why you would use a distributor. But it is a meaningful size part of the market, is this distributor part of the market. And they've got about 22% of that market. So they're the biggest player within the distributor packaging market in the UK. They've got 20,000 customers and no customers more than 1% of turnover. So very fragmented and diversified customer base, which makes it, you know, really kind of, you know, de-risked from losing a customer perspective. Is it cyclical? Yeah, there are elements of cyclicality, but their customer base is so broad across retail and industrials that it's not going to operate like a traditional retailer in terms of its cyclicality. Just they've seen some weakness in the e-commerce businesses that they serve more recently, which has been a bit of a dampen to the top line. But fundamentally, it's very well run. They've got a 10-year earnings CAGR of 14%.
Right.
And that's made up of about 4% organic growth annually on average, about 3% annual acquired growth. They've been consolidating the very fragmented distributor market within the UK, and also meaningful expansion in group operating margins over the last 10 years, from 4 to sort of 8.5. And so it's sort of a very good value growth stock. If you look at the top line, you think, oh, that's not very attractive. But historically, you combine single digit, you know, low to mid single digit organic growth with some acquisitive growth and margin expansion, and you can have a very powerful earnings story. And 11 times earnings for that quality of growth, consistent growth, that seems the wrong price to us. We think it should trade on a higher multiple. The chief executive has been there for 20 years.
Right.
So that's another attraction. And they've got a, I mean, they really, really know their sector.
Yeah.
He pretty much knows all the distributors in the UK that at some point want to sell up. It's the market's very fragmented. There are lots of family run companies serving a region, and he stays in touch with them all, and he will buy their business when they're ready to sell. It's as simple as that. He does all the due diligence he needs. He only buys good quality ones. So there's an expansion into Europe that's gathering some speed, and we really like it.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, good solid business trades at the peg ratio of less than one, and you know, for a long-term compounder. Okay, let's move to one which is the shares looks incredibly cheap. Tech Services does language translation, RWS, and I guess it trades on at just over 8x PE. And it's got sort of like a, you know, I think it's been doing a stock buyback. So it's probably got about sort of like a neutral balance sheet, no net debt, no net cash, et cetera. We don't know exactly how much it is. Pays a big dividend yield, 6.5%. And I guess the investors are just a bit concerned, aren't they, in terms of what regenerative or, you know, AI is going to do to the business in terms of, you know, automatic language translation. But a lot of bad news again is priced in.
Yeah, they've had issues.
Okay.
They've had issues over the last few years. I mean, it was a darling of the stock market for years. Every fund manager owned it, and it was, you know, highly rated, very successful, and market leader in the space of kind of language translation. I mean, they did an acquisition in 2020 of SDL, which was another listed business in a space. And I think that was really where the issue started. And then things have evolved. They had to increase investment, which the market didn't like. They had a failed offer from private equity, which the market didn't like. They've had management changes, which the market didn't like. And now you've got AI in the background. People thinking that you know, the company's not going to exist in a few years potentially. Our view is that the concerns around AI are totally unknown and probably overblown. This is a company that utilizes AI. The level of complexity around some of the language translation when you're dealing with IP is really quite complex, but in any case, they're able to utilize AI in their day-to-day operations at the moment. So, you know, there's a habit for the market to get, I think, very worried about things like AI when they come along and there's this big technological advancement. But the reality is, it does take a lot longer for these things to filter through. And there can be lots of opportunities. I'm not disputing that there are potential threats.
Yeah.
But to think that it's going to just disappear in a matter of weeks or a year or two is in our view incorrect.
Yeah.
Look, there are transactions in the sector that are going through at 12 to 15 times PE.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a stock that's trading on about 7. So, you know, we think it's materially undervalued. It's a market leader, and, you know, look at what happened with Spirent. The size of the premium on the bid. I mean, I think, look, it just because it's very cheap doesn't mean it can't stay cheap for a very, very long time. It's hard to know what the catalysts are going to be. Maybe they need to deliver some trading updates that are demonstrating that they're back on the front foot. Maybe they need to, you know, have another PE bid. It's hard to know exactly what the market wants to see, but for sure it's on the back foot at the moment. But, you know, I think that's the opportunity with very high quality business that's been out of favor for a few years, trading on a very low multiple now. That doesn't look right to us.
Yeah, no, I agree. For a 720 million market cap business to trade on just over 8x PE and generating a lot of cash with a good dividend yield. You just got to look at that. Looks like mispriced to me on the numbers front. That's for sure. Okay, well, let's just hit a couple of others just to close it off. We've got let's do Restore, which is a big turnaround, which does archiving things like, you know, documents for the government and for companies into underground, but also does sort of like recycling of the technology and office basically moves and stuff like relocations. What's your sort of latest on this one? Because the margins have sort of like fallen, but they trade at a very, very cheap valuation. I think their founder and chief executive has come back as well to sort of kick the business back into shape.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we bought into it about 5 months ago when the previous chief executive, Charles Skinner, announced that he was returning, and he managed the company for 10 years from 2009 to 2019 and delivered shareholders a 10x return.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of credibility that comes with him for sure. Over the management team between when he left and when he's come back, so the 4 years, 2019 to middle of 2013, the company had pursued a very acquisitive strategy. It had leveraged up the balance sheet with floating debt as interest rates rose, which is pretty poor in many ways. And operationally, they made a lot of poor decisions. So that resulted in a series of downgrades and a big derating in the stock. It used to trade on, in the heyday, it was 25 times, but 20 to 22 times. And all of a sudden it was down on about 9 times when things kind of bottomed out. But fundamentally, the business, the core business, box storage, they're a market leader in physical document storage. It's a very boring business, but it's very high quality, very high margins, 30% operating margins in that business. So, you know, the market got fed up with the management team. There's an opportunity to get the business back on track by doing some, in our view, some very basic things. And this is not our idea. This is what Charles is saying, and he's been through it with investors, and he's been to see us. So, you know, his view is that he can increase the profit of the company, 30% or so through doing some pretty basic things. One is increasing pricing across their box business, which they haven't done more aggressively enough the last few years. And it's easy win, straight to the bottom line. The other is reducing head office overheads. Under the previous chief executive, their head office went from 9 to 50 people. So bringing that back down, paying down the debt, which currently is costing quite a lot of money in terms of interest expense. So not doing any more M&A, only very selective, and using the cash generation to pay down the debt will increase the profitability of the company, and focusing on other operational efficiencies like property, portfolio consolidation. They've got various sites that can be consolidated, and they've identified about, I don't know, £6 to 8 million in property saving costs through consolidating various sites. So if you add all those different components up, you get profits that are broadly 30% higher than where they are today, 2 to 3 years probably, and that in itself would warrant a much higher multiple, because it would be a better business, better margins, and I think the rating will recover as people start to see that this business is not an 11x PE business that it is today. The peers internationally trade on 15 to 20 times. Those that are structured as a REIT, you know, will be paying dividend, you know, will be valued even more highly than that. So it's a recovery stock with potentially quite a lot of upside.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, Iron Mountain, I think, trades at about 16x PE. Okay, let's just finish it off with Victoria Plumbing, which basically does online delivery of all things, your plumbing, sort of like your taps and your sinks and stuff like this, I think. So what sort of piqued your interest here? Because, I think it floated about 2021, bit of a stock market darling, and plumbing in the UK has had a bit of a tough period of recently. Obviously repair and maintenance seems to be doing all right, but it's all that new build and improvements as in the cost of living crisis has just been pushed to the right.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's another example of a company that listed in the IPO bonanza that no one ever talks about, by the way. Everyone tells you the stock market's dead, but they forget to tell you there were 100 IPOs in 2021. But, you know, a lot of them were very aggressively priced. And this is one that fundamentally was very highly valued. It benefited from a lot of growth through COVID as everything went online, and they had a big sort of reliance on international suppliers for their products. So they got very badly hurt by the increase in freight pricing that came after COVID, and then the energy pricing. So it's been really difficult, and the shares have pretty much, you know, gone down, I think, probably 75 to 80% from their peak price, if not more. But you know, some of these businesses are gonna survive and are gonna win. And we think they look very well positioned to do that. So they are the leading UK bathroom retailer. They've got about 19% market share across the UK. They are the predominant online retailer. And the online penetration is still only about 35% of the market, and there's no reason why that can't continue to grow. I think it's different to some retailers in that it's predominantly its own brand. 75% is their own brand, so there's better margins. The own brand is about 60% gross margin versus third party brands, which is about half that. They've grown their market share from 3% to 19% in 6 years, which is pretty remarkable. One of their key competitors, a company called Victoria Plum. I know it's absurd that they have such similar names. They went into administration and they had 7% market share. So that market share has come up for grabs. They've got a strong balance sheet, 45-ish million net cash. And we think the profitability is starting to recover. If you look what's happened to energy and freight, you know, coming back to more normal levels. And, you know, this is a company that's, you know, got the customer base to deliver the margin if you know the environment, you know, on the cost base does continue to move in the right direction. They've been moving to a new warehouse, which will improve efficiencies, and provide, you know, more margin expansion and opportunity to grow into other products like tiles and lighting. So we're not massively invested in retail or kind of consumer discretionary, but where there are unique opportunities where companies, you know, we think are really well positioned and have a long runway of growth ahead of them, then, you know, we're prepared to make investments, and this is one of them.
Okay. Just finally then, in terms of how would you sort of what would sort of trigger Josh to sell a particular position? What would be a, you know, sort of like the things that would stand out? I mean, not delivery of the business plan or whatever like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to have parameters that you try and stick to, because you can't do everything, and that's one thing that, you know, is definitely, you know, something that I've learned, is you can't be a specialist in everything. And if you like investing in certain types of companies, then I think there's often a temptation to go into other areas, but often in my experience that hasn't worked out for me. So I think we like to stick to areas that we feel comfortable with and, you know, that very much fit our process. But within that, you know, if I think, look, there are various reasons for selling, not least because something better comes along and you want to try and keep something portfolio tight and with your best ideas. So there's always a natural level of attrition as new ideas come in and the weakest links are sold. But generally, I think, you know, any big deviation away from the business plan or signs that the competitive position is actually really under threat. You know, so I think that's something that we would, you know, look very closely at. We spoke about debt earlier on. A business that takes on debt unnecessarily or makes acquisitions unnecessary, there's often a management desire and incentive to grow very, very quickly because that's how they're remunerated. And if they haven't got a lot of equity in the business and they're remunerated through options or which are linked to 3-year targets and EPS, then you're pushed in a direction to be acquisitive and to do things quickly. But often that's not the right way to do things. Often actually the right way to do things is to just buy time and wait until things get difficult in the market, and then you can make acquisitions at much better multiples. So sometimes you have to be prepared to be a little bit, on the sideline with the best businesses, because they won't always be, trying to do things really, really quickly. And where management teams are trying to do things too quickly and make the next acquisition before they've integrated the one they just did, or, borrow more money or come back to the market to raise more money. These are things that we think are unnecessary and usually end badly.
Okay, good. Well, thanks again, Josh, for your time and excellent insights there. If somebody wants to invest in Whitman Asset Management or in your particular funds, how best to do that?
They can go onto our website and get in touch. We'd love to hear from them. We've got two funds in the small cap world, a small cap open-ended growth fund, which just had its 3-year track record actually, and is sort of top quartile since inception and is performing quite well at the moment. That's about 20 million of assets. And then we've got an AIM inheritance tax service for those that want small caps, but with the inheritance tax wrapper, which has been going for about 5 years. And that's a bigger strategy, about 75 million. So those are our small cap options, and they're both open indefinitely to new clients. So please get in touch.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, thanks again, Josh, and look forward in touching base here and those stock ideas performing in 6 to 9 months' time. So thanks
Brilliant.
A lot.
Thanks for your time.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.